Right, we're starting. Right, William, lovely. It's recording.
Welcome everybody. This is a probably an adaptive repeat of what happened last year, because we had three summers, absolutely freezing, and I thought you couldn't make it, so we're doing it again on a very big topic that I think is a general interest. Nice to have Nicole with us from the School of Politics and International Relations, Nottingham, and it's about solving the reproducibility crisis.
Thanks very much for having me. Right, so I'm probably not going to solve the reproducibility crisis, especially if I can't pronounce it, but there are some ideas that I have what you can do to, especially to help your students or your postdocs, maybe in your lab or those you are teaching, to get a better understanding about transparency and the importance of reproducibility in different fields. Can I just see by a show of hands, who here is in the natural sciences, in a lot of things? Okay, anyone in social sciences? Okay, those who weren't sure, what are you doing?
Statistician,
so basically everything. Okay, all right. Okay, let's start. Okay, so most scientists can't replicate studies by their peers. This is from 2017. This is a large project, a reproducibility project for cancer research, led by Tim Arrington. And they tried to replicate or rerun the experiments of 5 landmark cancer studies, and they could only get the same results in 2 of the 5 studies. In psychology, we have a similar problem. They have had a few reproducibility projects where many labs try to come together and reproduce studies. So there were 200 psychologists involved in this. They had 28 studies to replicate, and only 14 could be replicated. And in the other cases, something was initially significant, but not significant the second time around. Or some traits shown in participants that later in the replication will show. So there's and there are other scandals. I'll show you some more of problems of irreproducibility. So many studies that we know, that we read, and even highly regarded journals are not reproducible. And one of the problems, and we just talked about that, is one of the reasons for that is that authors sometimes don't like to share their data. Now, I know that in some fields, maybe in medical research, you almost always have to publish your protocols and your data, but in many fields, this is not standard. Who here knows the Reinhart-Rogoff scandal in economics? Anyone heard of this? One? Yeah? Okay. So I'll explain it. There was this very influential study by Reinhart and Rogoff in economics. Do you know them personally or anything, or is it just you've heard of the scandal?
Whether I know them personally.
No, yeah, you just heard about the scandal, but you're not connected to them.
No.
Okay.
Is this to do with high dimensional models?
Say again?
Is this to do with high dimensional models?
That I don't know, but I'll tell you what I know. Okay, so this study said that it showed with an econometric model, with using data from different countries, GDP, growth, debt, and so on, countries with higher debt had slower growth. And so this study was used by politicians to introduce austerity measures and policies. For example, maybe cutting down on welfare. And so what happened next was that a student in their class, as a class assignment, was told, why don't you take this study, download the data, and try to reproduce it, and see if you can get the same results, basically just to learn statistics. And the student just tried what he could and never got to the same results. He asked them for their data set, which they, after having to ask a few times, gave to him, and he always got different results. And in the end, it turned out that in copy-pasting over data in Excel spreadsheets that a row had moved one row up or down, and it had distorted the whole correlation analysis. And that's what led to a paper that is giving basically wrong policy advice. So this came out in 2013, and this is at least for the social sciences the first big scandal that I can remember. I know that reproducibility as an issue has been discussed for a long time, but this is kind of what got the ball rolling a little bit. Now politics, my own field, more recently 2015 had their own scandal. A student from, I think it was UCLA, wrote a really nice paper and got it published in Science, which is not very common for a student in political science. He was a PhD student. He wrote a paper about is it effective when you go door-to-door campaigning for equality and gay marriage. So he had devised a survey experiment where he wanted to prove that if you do a lot of grassroots campaigning and you go door-to-door and try to explain to people why equality is a good thing and that gay marriage should not be forbidden, that you can actually persuade people to change their attitudes. So he found this effect in change of attitude and published it. And obviously this is a very sexy topic, top journal. Another student, again, as part of a class assignment in an introductory statistics course, was asked to replicate this study. And he was merely asked to download the data, rerun the code, and just see if he can get to the same result, running some regression analysis or something. And so he wrote to the original author asking, can I see your data, please? The author said, no, there are some privacy concerns. These are human subjects involved. Absolutely fair enough. So the replicator student asked, OK, could you maybe anonymize the data? Or maybe just give me a random sample of it so that I can see how the data looks like. I just want to try out and see how you did your analysis. So suddenly, the original author said, I've deleted the data set because I'm concerned about privacy for my participants, and it's just gone. And that was a bit odd. So the university started investigating, and it turned out that the original author had faked the whole study. And all the data was fabricated. He made the data up so that it fit the analysis, and everything turned out into nice figures and tables and significant. He also had faked a few things on his CV, so it wasn't just that particular study. Now that was really embarrassing for the university, but also for his thesis supervisor, because he had completely trusted his student and never checked the data. Maybe you also have students who you completely trust, which I think is a nice default mode, and maybe you have never asked to see how they have produced their data, or to see the raw data, or see the surveys. So something to think about. And this was a big scandal that made it into the New York Times, which meant that in political science, people are now talking about transparency and research quality in a different way. A connected problem is, it's not just problems of authors. Few journals enforce data upload. So this is depending on which field you are in. You might think that's not true, or you might think exactly that's what happens in my field. So this happens, for example, in my field. There was a study, luckily this has changed a little bit now, in 2013, that found that out of 100 political science journals, only 18 had a replication policy that asks the authors to upload the data. And there are some follow-up studies now across different fields. I'm also involved in one of them, and when you start looking at the websites of the journals, it's really interesting how some really good journals don't say anything, or they might say something like, we encourage the authors to upload their data and code, but they don't enforce it. So most scientific knowledge that we trust remains unchecked. Solutions. Has anyone heard of the TOP guidelines or TOP guidelines? Yeah, Open Science Framework? Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is one attempt which tries to bring in journal editors and change journal policies. Behind this is Brian Nosek, Open Science Framework people, that have done a huge consulting among all kinds of stakeholders, and so now more and more journals are basically signing the TOP or top guidelines. And so what the guidelines do, So they have 8 different standards right here, and they have different levels. And so the idea is that each journal can use these as kind of almost like a template and pick and choose where they want to be given their field. For example, if you are in history and everything is archived research, it will be very hard to ask your office for some data code or something. So this is about, for example, data transparency. So on a level 3, all data must be published in a trusted repository, while on level 1, the journal just encourages the authors to share the data. Or if you look at pre-registration of studies, so in some of your fields this might be very normal, the journal might just say nothing, and a journal on level 3 requires that you pre-register your analysis plan, all your hypotheses, all your plans for your data, so that later someone can actually go and check if in between your plan and your published work there has been happening some p-hacking or something like that. Okay? Well, here, relevant for me, because I work on replication, a journal might discourage the submission of replication studies because these are not original novel work, just redoing what someone else did. Or a journal might encourage submission of replication studies, or they might even say you can pre-register your replication plans, they will then check it and get it through the peer review, and then you can publish your replication, whether it failed or not. So even if you confirm the original results, you still have a chance to get published. Which can be really important, because there have been some accusations that replicators are just out to find other studies to fail so that they can then have a big scandal and get published on it. Okay, I'll talk about that a little bit more later. So these are the top guidelines. Of course, funders play a role. Many funders now ask for good research data management. They ask where the data will be published. They also say if you cannot publish the data for privacy or copyright concerns, that you say how someone else could try and get this data through the official channels. These are just examples. Making data discoverable and enable reuse. And finally, and this is kind of the thing that I do is doing replications. So when I was still at Cambridge, and now at Nottingham, but when I was at Cambridge, I ran a replication workshop with social science students. And our goal was to pick a paper, try to get the data, get the code, mostly there was no code, and then rerun the analysis. And this was really just to learn statistics. But now there are actually all these big initiatives that are trying to do large-scale replications or even meta-analyses. So replication seems to be more of a thing, and I came through it because I was teaching statistics to undergrads. No, that's not true, actually, to graduate students. And I was thinking of innovative ways of making them work with real-life data, and that's how I got to replication. So the rest of the talk will be about how to do replications and how to do good replications. Yes, how to and how to not replicate a study. This is a slide that I stole from Florian Markowitz at Cancer Research UK. Let's be honest, if you get an email from someone that says, oh, I love your research, your article has been so inspiring, you're super happy, and then you read on, I have decided to replicate your study. Okay? That would stress me. And the problem is that many people have, there has been a discussion, especially in psychology, and a psychologist from Cambridge was also involved, who feel that maybe the replication police is coming, the replication bullies are at work. They are just trying to find a study to show that it failed, the replication failed, so that they can then point fingers at other people. And so when I talk about replication and in the way I talk with my students about replication, this is not what I want, okay? I don't want people to think the police is coming around to get them, or witch hunt is often a word that is used. I would like for replication not to be a kind of question of life and death. Either your replication was a success, original author would be happy, or the replication was a complete failure, and the original author's reputation might be in danger. This is not what I want, but I want this. Replication 2.0, I would like, that's what I try and teach my students, to think about replication in terms of overcoming obstacles. Because in every field you have methodological obstacles, missing data, or problems with sample size. I work in human rights, that's my main hat is work on globalization of human rights and corruption. I almost always have very difficult data, and this poses methodological problems that I think as a community, political science community, we should try and overcome. And by doing replications, we can try and work on these problems collectively, rather than pointing fingers at original authors that have supposedly done something really bad. Okay, but before I go on, I need to talk about what is a replication, and I probably should have done that first. Each discipline has their own labels for this, but I'm using this because I think it's very easy to make that distinction. I distinguish between a duplication and a replication. A duplication is the verification of research results. So your main kind of question is, were there some errors in the original study? If I rerun it, there might be some different findings. Or this is often used in student learning context. And the main thing to remember is that this is basically using the same data or very, very similar data and the same methods. This is for verification purposes. But a replication really tests the robustness of published work. So here the question is more, are the results due to change? Let's say I change the context. Does that mean suddenly all the results change? Maybe there were suboptimal methods being used. Maybe the context in which the original study does work is very narrow. So here you would collect new data and you would apply new methods, improved methods. And this is important because if you then get different results as a replicator, you also have to again distinguish in how you talk about those different results. When I did the replication workshop with my students, I don't remember any case where a student had a complete exact same set of figures and tables. There were almost always at least small changes. And so on, the way we communicate these is very important. For duplications, the reasons are hopefully often knowable. It could be an honest mistake, like the Excel spreadsheet error. It could be a mistake by the original author, but also by the replicator or duplicator in this case. Sometimes the reason why you can't duplicate the original study is that it has been quite opaque in its methods section. It may just not have been clear how they've run their model. Or it could be due to chance in some cases. So what I recommended to my students, because some of them extended their replication and published it in the journal, before they did that, I recommend actually to everyone, duplicate your own study before journal submission. So give your data and your code to your colleague or your students or a friend, just at least, at the very least, ask them to run the code and see if they get the same results. If a replication comes to different results, the story is different because you have used different data and different methods, and who is surprised that you would get at least slightly different results. So here it's very important to discuss exactly why you think the results are different. So this can be mysterious, sometimes you just don't know, but you have to be very good at interpreting, I have used this other measure for democracy, this might cause the change. It could also be that the change was caused because the original effect really doesn't exist. So you have to be very nuanced in how you describe exactly at which step you deviated from the first study, what you changed and why the results changed. I'll argue a little bit later that I actually think that using words, the replication has failed, may be counterproductive because you're passing a binary judgment when you should maybe be much more, it's a much more complex thing and you might want to be more nuanced in this. So here's some tips. If you want to do that in your lab with your students, or if you're teaching and you want to use a replication in your teaching, which I still do at Nottingham as well, or if you want to run a replication study yourself, the first tip is transparent planning. So if you are replicating someone else, you check that they are very transparent. Obviously, you have to be extremely transparent. So it must be very clear to you from the start if you are really running a replication with new data and new code, or if you're just out to duplicate. Second point is try to be very transparent and reproducible yourself. So your replication study or duplication study should say why the original study was chosen and how. Your own methods section has to be crystal clear. Some people say replications should be pre-registered so that anyone can see if you have kind of massaged the original study to a point so that you would find failed results, because you want to avoid that kind of accusation. And yeah, as I said, cross-check your replication or duplication before submission. Also, something that my students have sometimes been struggling with, they felt they were very amateurish, and when they wrote emails with original authors trying to get to why their results differed, they sometimes felt they were being seen as very kind of not being an expert. Yeah. So when you replicate or when you ask students to replicate, it's really important to engage with the literature to make yourself an expert and then go about rewriting the code, because then you can make much more informed decisions. Also, the extension of a duplication, when you then extend it and collect new data and new code, should not be motivated by playing around to see what happens, but really by theory. Why is this measure of human rights conceptually problematic, and why should I then use that measure? So the idea is to be theory-led and not data-led here. So this is a slide that I used for my students for 4 years, and I think I may have changed my opinion on it now. The idea is, this is specifically for students, which study should I pick to replicate? And for me, the perfect replication project, at least in the classroom, used to be, it must be obviously a relevant and important paper, that still holds. Maybe these are results that are generally accepted, but no one has really double-checked them. Maybe there are some control variables that should have been in there. Maybe the measures are outdated. So kind of, you look around, you find an interesting paper, and you think there's something wrong with it. And then you think, maybe I should replicate it. That's the idea behind it. For students, I would always also say they need to know the methods, because I had a lot of students who thought, oh, multi-level modeling, I can easily learn that, but then they kind of had troubles rerunning the code because they just didn't understand what they were doing. Now, the way I've changed my mind about this a little bit is that someone can easily say, well, you picked a study that you think is bad, you did a replication, you showed it's bad. That's not a problem in a student learning environment, but if everyone always picks bad studies to replicate, and then we publish all these failed replications, we have never looked at the good studies. So there might be a distorted view of science, and all these scandals might mean that the public thinks that all science is really, really bad. So some big replication initiatives advise to pick studies randomly, to have maybe three groups of studies, top tier, medium, and lower tier, and then do some random selection so that every study gets a chance to be selected for replication. And this could prevent selection bias, and this could prevent that someone else would say, well, you were just the replication police coming after a particular author. And this is often done in larger initiatives. So this is why there's a question mark here, because I'm wondering what are the best ways to pick a study. Okay, practical steps. I'm just going to put everything here. This is what I've used for my students. You select a paper, you try and access data and code. Most of the time, at this point, after 3 weeks, students never heard from the original author. So I advise my students, if it's not already out there on the Harvard Dataverse or some other repository, pick another study. Identify each variable again. Many studies have some weird variable names. I'm sure you know those headers in your stats program with variables that you know by heart, but it's something that someone else may never know. So my students had a lot of problems figuring out what is that variable? Is it logged or not? Is it divided by this or not? So this also can take quite a while. Then you try and reproduce the tables and figures, and you compare with the original study, which means you have basically at this point done a duplication. But if you extend it and you work with new data, new methods, maybe have a new hypothesis, theoretically motivated, you are then stepping into a full replication, at least according to this definition that I'm using. So this can take months, and I have a few students who did publish their replication, but only the year after, because they just, you know, they are students, they are busy. I'm actually very proud that they managed to get something out of it in the end. Again, you run your models, you compare. It's really good to get feedback. They may want to contact the original authors. And then there's journal submission. And these are kind of the steps that all of my students have gone through. This is something that may be completely off for you guys if you are not in political science or in the social sciences, but this is just things I've collected that people do when they want to improve methods. Probably the biggest one is power calculations and increasing the sample size or looking at how well the sample was chosen. And then it just depends on what you work on. In my field, often, so in human rights, if you look at human rights in developing countries, there's hardly any data. And so whenever a data set has been revised and approved and updated 5 years later, it could be totally worth it re-examining the same question because a lot of things may have changed. You could also look at subsets of your data, different regions of the world. A big problem generally is missing data handling. In political science, we usually just list-wise delete a whole row. If one value is missing, the whole row is deleted. But you could also do multiple imputation instead and see how that changes the results. And there are some other things, some robustness checks, how sensitive are the data to outliers, the typical things. In my field, unfortunately, if you take foreign direct investment as a measure of globalization, half of the authors in my field divided by GDP to account for the market size of a country into which FDI flows. The other half doesn't divide by GDP. Some take FDI stock that is present in the country for many years. The other half takes FDI flow each year. And I've just given you four options of measuring globalization. And in the field of FDI and human rights, the literature is completely divided. Some of them say there's a positive effect of globalization on human rights, some of them negative, and there's another 10 studies saying there is no significant effect. And this could all have to do with how you specify this one tiny variable. So these are things one could do to add value to a duplication. And if this was an experimental study, you would redo the experiment and change the experiment. Now the last part I want to get at is rhetorical sensitivity, and this has developed over time because the students have been asking me how should I write my email to an author not to piss them off, or if I want to publish this replication, how do I say politely that I think there are errors without exposing or embarrassing the original author, who may also be a really established figure in my field and might be sitting on my next grand panel or something. So my first tip is avoiding binary judgments, putting failed replication in the title, unless someone has actually fabricated data, that is a different thing. If I find that controversial, I think it's much better to present the diverging and the different results step by step and interpret them and say exactly why you think those results are different. Also, don't make it personal. I mean, it sounds like this. Everyone should be doing this anyways, but I've seen some replication studies that do not sound very very professional. So collaborative language, constructive language, accepting that honest mistakes are human. I'm pretty sure if someone came and replicated a paper of mine, they would find an error. I've already found an error myself. Actually, not myself, but I gave my own study to my students in their stats class a few months ago, and they had to replicate a paper, a table of it. And they gave me these weird results, and I figured out there was a coding error. So the results generally hold, but the way I've described the variable in one of the tables is wrong. I said it's coded from 0 to 5, but it's coded from 0 to 8. And in the proofreading stage, I just never saw that. And I only found out because I gave my students the table to look at. So, honest mistakes are human. And I think also it's good to make clear what the positive contribution of the original author is. So because you would have never picked a study that you think is irrelevant or unimportant, you would have picked a study that has made an important contribution to the field, and I think it's important when you write up your replication report to say that and to acknowledge the work the original author has put in. And then finally, something that comes up all the time when I talk about replication, the judgment of the replicator is not final. Just because it's the last judgment and it comes after the original study, it may just be that they differ in their way they chose their variables for good reasons. Just because you are the person coming temporarily after or chronologically doesn't mean you have the last say and you say all of this research is wrong. It's much more constructive to discuss how the literature can move forward to solve such and such methodological problem in the field. Okay, here's some juicy stuff. I collected replication chains to show how original authors and replicators talk to each other publicly. I don't know how they talk to each other privately. A replication chain is this. You have an original study. Someone duplicated or replicated it and published it in the journal. And then often the original author would get the chance to comment in the subsequent issue or maybe even in the same issue. And I looked at these three to see what is how people talk. Here is what replicators write. Okay? An example. We find that coding errors, selective exclusion of available data, and unconventional weighting of summary statistics led to serious errors. If we cannot even reproduce the original results using the same publicly available data, there is no need for further commentary. Quite harsh. Not too bad. This is how original authors respond to their replicators. Less realistic, inconsistent with the substantive literature, and the replication is of limited utility. Or the replication is fundamentally flawed. Or statistical, computational, and reporting errors invalidate its conclusions. So they hit back hard. This is all from political science. I'm sure in psychology or other fields you would find similar types of ways they talk to each other. Now, I'm almost finished. Here is something I've tried to take the table from the top guidelines that we saw earlier, how that was about how journal editors can encourage data sharing. This is a table that tries to give some advice on how you can run a replication study that is constructive and transparent. And so it's a summary of everything I've said so far. For example, study selection. This is, by the way, not set in stone. I'm not sure if this makes all sense, I basically made it up. So a study selection that is just picking a bad study may not be so great, but part of a larger replication initiative that randomly selected the study may be better. Research design, I think a duplication is very useful, especially in the classroom, but a full replication based on new data and new code can teach us much more about the state of the field. Pre-registration of the replication, so obviously yes gets to the higher level. Results by write-up, I think if you just give a binary and very harsh account of this study is all wrong, this is not so good, but constructive and non-personal language would get to a better level. This one here, I'm undecided about contacting the original author. Maybe we can talk about it in the discussion. I decided that I think it's probably best practice to at least invite the original author to comment on your results, maybe even to collaborate, or maybe less good but still would inform them. Some people say not informing the original author is not fair practice, because they would just at some point open a journal, or well, on their computer nowadays, and see that someone says their study was faulty. I've also had people saying you should definitely not contact the original authors, because then already bias might creep in if you start talking to them, because they may want to influence you to not finding their study has not replicated. So on this one I'm not quite sure, but I think for a collegial kind of environment where you don't have the replication police coming, I think it would be good to work with the original authors, at least inform them and give them a chance to comment. And then transparency, that goes for every type of research. If you don't share your materials, then who is going to believe your replication? So this is kind of an idea of when someone wants to go about to replicate something, what they could use as guideline and pick these different things and make very clear how they went about it. But I want to end with a nice example. What constructive replicators write, because I also stumbled across an example where someone wrote something in a way that I felt that was really constructive. So the constructive replicator wrote, "This is not a critique of existing papers, which faithfully report careful studies. Rather, replication with a different event, sample, and time is a way to move the literature forward to assess robustness." Or they also said, because there was some of the results were the same and some of the results did deviate from the original study, "Our study is not to be taken as a definitive evidence that the extant literature overstates the extent of irrelevant events." That is just the topic, basically. "Yet it serves as a cautionary prompt to the next generation of work." So they are trying to be very forward-looking and not just saying the replication thing. So this example is from a study by Busby and Druckmann, 2018. And then I looked at the original study, and that was a study by Busby and Druckmann, 2015. Okay? So they replicated their own paper because they felt they found some errors, or maybe they felt they found that they could do things better. So you're now maybe not so surprised anymore that they are being very constructive to their younger selves. And so initially I thought, no, I can't use this example now because it's just, you know, I'm going to be also nice to my younger self. But I thought, actually, no. This is exactly how you should replicate. Okay? So this is my golden rule. Replicate others as you would like to be replicated yourself. Okay? This is the one thing I wanted to bring across, and this is what I'm going to tell my students in the future. Think about your younger self, who was sitting there doing all the work, and how would you talk to your younger self when you replicate? All of the things I've said are in two papers. They are freely available on the OSF. This is about teaching. This is from the Cambridge workshop that I taught. And this is a paper with Jeremy Fries, a sociologist, where we talk a lot about how replicators and original authors should talk constructively to each other to avoid things like replication police. Thank you very much.
A few thoughts came to my mind. There's a chap I know, and they made a big error with missing data because they code them as 99 and 999, but they forgot to actually put that in the spreadsheet. And so it came out, you know, 99 was seen as a real value. It's so easy for these things to happen, and it's human error. And it may not one person involved in even data collection, one person checking the date, it's going to be mistakes. I've had people come to me, oh, you know, we've had to change the date, we found another error. I mean, it is this accidental error thing, but it's, you know, you can put it all on open access and people may not realise there's a mistake there. So it's not a sort of, there's still problems even with making things available, because there's mistakes in them to start with, but they may not be detected.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the, I don't know if it's a solution, because we can't afford lots of people doing these things, you know.
I mean, what some journals do, this is not going to solve all those problems, but some journals, I know in political science, they do pre-publishing replications, so they hire some graduate students maybe, or they work with another institute, and they let them replicate the study, duplicate the study, I should say, before it gets published. So that would catch kind of coding errors and bugs, or having sent in the wrong data set, that can catch that. But all the other errors, I could not say how much I think the error rate in the average journal is. I'm guessing it's pretty high. Some errors might actually change the result considerably, and some errors may just not influence, let's say, the p-value all that much. We can only hope that these, you know, those that don't have a huge influence on the data, that those are the majority, for sure.
So you talked quite a bit about replication possibly affecting people's feelings, researchers' feelings, and so on. What do you do in cases where public policy or some large policy is based on results in the field that are demonstrably false or like
What do you do? I mean, making these errors public is important, but I say that with a bit of hesitation, because it can also easily be abused. If you think of climate change, for example, the discussion about if it's real or not, to which extent is it real, can we trust scientists, or are scientists just some remote people sitting in their ivory tower trying to fool the normal folks? So I think what generally really helps is scandals are helpful, because scandals wake up a whole field, and scandals help. For example, my students only wanted to replicate because they knew about these scandals, and they thought they got, you know, motivated to do something about it. So making it public, but it when you think about how journalists, and I used to be a journalist, sometimes make things bigger than they are, or write in relatively simplistic terms, that can also be a problem. A lot of scientists already do all kinds of consulting, going to, I don't know what, the Houses of Parliament or something, and I guess if I was one of these people and I would want to present a result, I would probably maybe ask someone first to double check that the result that I am presenting there is really 90% true, or something like that. But I don't know what, I mean, the general solution I would say is be transparent, replicate a lot, make everything freely available so that no one can say you tried to hide something, and make it public when you found errors that affect policy. Yeah?
Could you possibly go back to your top guidelines?
Yeah.
While you're getting there, does TOP stand for anything in particular?
You mean the orange one or these?
The original one, yeah.
Yeah. They are at the very beginning. Just going to do a little... Hang on. There must be a better way to do this. But I don't know what that is on this computer, so... yeah. Nearly there. Did I go already? Did I pass it?
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
there we go. Yeah.
So my first question was, does TOP stand for anything?
Yes, transparency and openness promotion guidelines.
Thank you. And secondly, if you compare the pre-registration for replication And I'm thinking more the replication, registered reports, etc. There doesn't appear to be a correspondingly severe restriction on original publication. So that, for example, somewhere on the replication ones, level 3 says that the journal has to decide whether to publish it without seeing the results of the replication study. It seems to me that there ought to be something like that on the original studies, that journals have to decide whether or not to publish the data based on the design of the study in the interest of the question without knowing the results.
Yeah.
And before the data is collected.
Yeah, so I quickly skimmed over this. You're absolutely right, and I think maybe when they came up with this, there wasn't a lot of support for what you're saying yet. This is sometimes called blinded peer review, where you block out the results. Absolutely agree. That should be, I mean, either this should be level 4 or this should move into here. You know, the more journals are taking up these standards. I mean, some people say, why did you include 0? That's just, some journals will pick 0 and pretend they are doing the TOP or top guidelines, which means they are not really doing anything. I guess that in the next few years, maybe this will be adjusted towards becoming more thorough or strict, and that would be something to include. So a journal in political science has done it as an experiment. They ask people to send in an analysis and black out all the, and then it was sent out for peer review, and then they had basically a guarantee that it would be published either way, if it's all significant or not, against publication bias. I talked to them a bit later. I had thought this would be like a big, flashy kind of publishing of this really cool special issue, but none of other people submitted anything to that. And I don't know why that is. A few studies were submitted and published, they went through the blind peer review process. But at that point in time, I thought it was super innovative. Authors did not want to be connected to that initiative. Maybe, I don't know why, maybe they thought they would look bad if they go through that kind of peer review. I don't know.
Are you aware that many journals will put the same in system for registration? Is it in practice?
Yeah, that's
in fact, they don't.
So I've heard that this is slowly changing because people are writing blog posts and on Twitter they are kind of calling them out on it. But there are journals that have a replication. I published in a journal and they have a replication policy. I know that because they asked me for my data, but I wanted to see another study's data and they said, yeah, kind of the author didn't upload it, and then what could we do? Because they didn't ask for the data beforehand, at that point in time they asked for the data after it was accepted and published. Same with pre-registration. So technically you'd have to double check everything. And I mean, there are a lot of crowdsourced initiatives now on replication, checking pre-registrations with the original data. There are a lot of things going on, but I mean, you cannot check everything. You kind of, yeah.
Can you comment on methodology?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So, for example, I often need a paper that's not just not include data, but will say adjusted for age as part of the system there, without specifying what that means.
Yeah.
Which basically means that it's essentially going to be
adjustable.
I mean, and then you observe that without having to do any study or time.
Yeah. So there's now there are now a few research papers in the world of replication, papers on how to do science, that talk about writing better method sections will already help with the whole problem. It used to be a much bigger problem when we didn't have such a thing as online appendices where you could write out your whole variable code book and all these things. Now there's not so much of an excuse anymore because every journal is online. And so there was one study done by Katsami Do and someone else, and they tried to look through the top journals in, I think it was in my field actually, and they tried to have criteria and then rate how easy is it just from the methods section to understand what the authors did. and they said that the quality of method sections is abysmal. So there are people acknowledging your point now, and but there's a similar to the replication initiative or the transparency initiative, like they are slowly people are acknowledging it. But journalists should ideally have, what is this, maybe analytic transparency? It just says code sharing, but there is more than just code sharing. In your paper, you need to have the equation, say what everything is, what are all your adjustments, and I think ideally you would say in which software you've done it, which version of the software, and ideally also which function, because that can already change everything. And this could be a footnote or in the online appendix, so I think journalists should really ask for that, but... Yeah.
In my mind's eye, I'm thinking that if somebody replicates the analysis, they have to, you would hope they would go through the exact original data set with the same assumptions, with the same software that you've just described, and you would hope that they would get the same results. However, if there was another group were to duplicate the entire study at a different point in time, I personally would expect to see a different set of results coming out. I would not want to see the same results as in the original study, because if looking at something, say, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, what I'm studying now, time has moved on, the system, the entirety of what you're looking at has changed. So you might be looking for some general type inferences, which might be a reflection of that time history, but I would not want to see the same results. I'd want to see differences in the duplicate study. But again, it's still these same assumptions of the data modelling, the integrity of the data, the missing data, da-da-da-da-da-da. If all that's not thought about, then the whole analysis is flawed, because you're not comparing like, even with the time changes.
Yep.
So, and the work I do in industrial statistics, mm-hmm. we talk about repeatability and reproducibility,
mm-hmm.
and one rogue value can completely out of 90 values can completely destroy the analysis,
mm-hmm.
and the engineers don't get it. They're hunting for the wrong thing, not just doing the necessary data integrity checking to make sure everything is okay. Because if you get that wrong, it completely throws everything else out.
Yep. Yep, agreed. Yeah?
There are so many issues going on here, I don't really know where to start and where to go on forever. But I count this as a kind of life scientist, editor of a journal, as somebody who helps students and others with statistics, or in terms of the impact to talk about some of the issues raising, and also someone who has not done so much replication study as described it, but it picked up on what I would say are substantial weaknesses of fact or interpretation in the literature, and tried to do it, frankly, under the radar through editorial officers, and I have mostly found it almost impossible, very, very difficult, even with journals to as high as Nature,
mm-hmm.
and as high as PNAS, where there are things that are obviously wrong. Even with Nature, who brought out their Life Sciences checklist, which you may have seen, will have, you know, a description in the checklist, which is obviously gone through editorial peer review, and then you read the paper, and it's not there. It's like they're living on to sort of separate planets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's driven, but in my own concerns as people in life sciences, it's so big, it's so diverse. You talk about the abysmal nature of material sections, and that's absolutely true. But the general quality of English for most and many of them come through is just appalling anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Gibberish sometimes. But those journals were responsible in the first instance to get it down to those levels, to look at the extent to which science or nature pare away the quality of an article,
mm-hmm.
In order to fill, you know, as much as they can as a journal. Now, of course, they say, oh, we're just not just fine, we're fine, bitten by their own policy. The problems that feed into the broad issue of replication are just colossal. And one of the problems I have with being really nice with these authors who may have made a mistake and can't have code and are really good people trying anyway, is that they bulldoze us for the past 20 years through their career, killing off people who would have said, actually, I don't think we can get away with this for any course of three. And the student or postdoc who says, oh, what is that, and get it published in Stahl or PNAS, gets the job. And they perpetuate the issue. Mm-hmm. And the number of people I know who dropped out because they think, you know, I don't want to do this. Just churning out rubbish, and they know it's rubbish, and they do not want to engage at the level that we're exposing. That's why people, you know, it's really a spiky world now. At least in life sciences, the stakes are so phenomenally high.
Yeah.
And it's just a book come out, curing medicine, like that.
Mm-hmm.
An excoriating review, or review of the book, which is excoriating
dying.
Mm-hmm. The quality of biomedical research, and the extent to which so-called stuff is actually translated into useful to zero, which is quite interesting. So
yep.
I find it all a bit depressing, and part of me is sitting there thinking, well, you're a social scientist, so it's on your subject, which is depressing as well. For me, I'm not going to get anywhere with a life scientist by doing this sort of thing. I need
yep.
to publish something new in it. So.
Yeah, so, yes. You're absolutely right. And when I said in the beginning, oh yeah, this talk is called Solutions, obviously you'd have to go on so many levels because it's such a complex problem, right? I've talked to CUP and gave a talk about the top guidelines. I talk to students because I think they are the future, and if I can indoctrinate them with not being sloppy and being really anal about their data and being transparent, I hope that for the next cohort something can change. Funders are more on board now. There are all kinds of, I know the there's a lot of people being promoters of open science and doing all kinds of things at different levels.
Funders have to show that their public funding politically is effective. That's the primary thing they have to do.
Mm.
So yes, MRC and BDSRC and all these people can say, oh, we need you to do power calculations, but they will produce templates for people who wouldn't know a power calculation if they, you know, sort of stab them in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And they just put any old numbers in. I've had this sent to me, that, oh, can you do my power calculation? What happens if I change letter F number, I think? I don't have a clue what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be let out of, you know, a bedroom, let alone let into a lab. And these will get through peer review.
Yeah.
at these research councils, because the people sitting around the committees are all the successful scientists for the past 20 years.
Anyone want to say something positive?
If I may comment on that. part of the problem is also that, at least in the life sciences, from the way we're talking about what you expect of the students, namely that they essentially are able to do the entire methodological part of their papers on their own. The Houston is probably a similar problem in the life sciences as well. But medical doctors, for instance, doing biostatistics, they are all amateurs. And so my question would be, where do you draw the line between you should be able to methodologically do this on your own, and at what point do you need external professional help by a data creation team and professional statisticians?
Mm. You mean for student teaching? Or in general.
Elaborate on that. I think we're expecting too much from some disciplines. You can't, not everybody can be an expert statistician or data manager, right?
Yeah, but if you want to publish an article, you better be. and I don't mean like expert as in many social scientists are not mathematicians or trained statisticians, but in their training we should equip them with really foundational things of, for example, sample size and power calculations. I never came across it in my training because in political science, unless you do experiments and surveys, you have a set number of countries and a set number of years for which someone has measured something, and that's your sample size, and you can't make it bigger. And so a lot of studies in what I've done, my study is the first one on human rights and FDI that did power calculations. I've never seen it before, never learned it. I went to an online tool and typed in my numbers, and then I tried to replicate it in R because I felt really stupid using these power calculation thingies. But I had never learned it. And I was only made aware that there is such a thing that I should be using because the peer reviewer said I'm not buying any of this, and they made me do it, and I'm glad I did. So I think training is important. The students in my replication workshop actually had external help, so we had TAs, more advanced PhD students or postdocs who would actually sit with them and handhold and run their analysis with them. And then the students had another type of help, which is, you could probably call it amateur help. They exchanged their replication projects with each other. And I thought it's just to rerun the code and, you know, before they go on and send me their final report. They actually had to sit down like for whole afternoons to help this other person understand their code because it was not well commented enough. So these are things everyone can do. I ask colleagues for help on the statistical thing that they are using, but I haven't used it all the time. And I ask other people all the time to cross-check before I submit. I'm not an expert on what I use, you know, panel data. I'm not the biggest expert in the world. I'm not a statistician. But I know enough so that I feel that I can judge other papers when I peer review them, and I can confidently say there might be some human error, something may have happened, but I know at least the method. So I think you have to strive to make yourself an expert or to get help from other people and ask them.
I think that's the key, is you've reached a level, or anybody's reached a level, and then they've got the confidence to engage with somebody else with more knowledge than they have. And it's not just restricted to life scientists or medical. As I said, I work in industrial statistics, and engineers haven't got a clue. Power and sample size variation don't know what it is. They measure something and they think that's the number, and it isn't. And you know, and I'm working with people who they're making strategic decisions based on the sample size too, not understanding the variation that could occur in the future. They just do not comprehend it. And yet, I'm told in Japan, their educational system is far different to ours, and statistics is embedded, not as a separate subject, but embedded into what they do as part of their weekly and annual studies. So there's something fundamentally wrong within the UK, and I've been campaigning for years as an external examiner to say we must have mathematical sciences and statistics working collaboratively with the university departments, so both benefit. But it's all about bums on seats and FTEs. It's got nothing to do with education. It's about how do I protect my department. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And I mean, depending on which university you study at, you may be lucky. If in my field, if you study at the University of Essex, you get proper training in statistics. I went there for summer schools. But I did my PhD here, and my department was fantastic, but they just didn't have a tradition of teaching statistics. So I had to self-teach and go to Essex and somehow learn it so that I can then later teach it. But you may just be unlucky, and often also students are anxious about statistics. I have a lot of students sitting in my classes in Nottingham who think, I had third-year undergrad students in my human rights module, and I let them read comparative studies as in quantitative studies, and they were really shocked that I made them do this, and they had to say what's the independent variable, what's the dependent variable, very basic stuff, because up until now they had never taken any statistics course. They could completely, in their module choices, get around it. And they went around it until they landed with me, and I had cheated them because the title of my module used to be called Quantitative Human Rights. No one signed up. Next year, we called it Comparative Human Rights. I had 35 students, and they all hated me. So this is the state of what happens in training. Yeah. This is why I go on about training, because I have not a very good training. I wish I had better training. But that's why I go on about trying to kind of force my students to have more contact with numbers, basically.
Yes, yes. I offer a counter to that, which is training is the problem and not the solution. Training is essentially teaching people to do something that you've been done before and follow the method. And the real issue here is that the entire method of what's being done isn't working. What we need is education, which is more to do with being able to independently think about things and work out the best way forward to do that. When I say something positive as well, which is that it might be that most science papers are false, and some of the papers that publish this have been that. And certainly the reproduction efforts that are going on at the moment, things like, as you mentioned, cancer research and so on, are suggesting that they small numbers of papers are reproducible. But we have a huge amount of data, and just because the data doesn't support the conclusions that are all over the place informed and are asserted in bizarre ways. The data, there's a lot of information there, and it can be analysed and without having to do large amounts of extra work, it can start from the basis of what's really going on, and you find out what's really going on. And there's a, if you remember the Nobel laureate, Linus Pauling, he had a Nobel laureate in chemistry, and went into applied things to other fields. And what he did was ignore people's conclusions and look at what their results were.
Mm-hmm. So he didn't read the discussion or conclusion, he would read the...
Well, he might read it, but the point is that if someone says a result and gives reference, well, you've got to decide for yourself whether that's a valid thing.
Yep.
And you've got to follow that reference and see what's actually being asserted, because there are certain... people will say things like, there are no cures for hangovers, and you follow the reference and it will say we tried these things in these specific ways,
mm-hmm.
and in this limited way we found these 8 cures not to work.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that also goes to sloppy referencing. Yeah, people reference what someone else had said, that this paper said, and they never actually read the original paper. That also happens a lot. That's why I like replication as a teaching method, because you really have to read this paper, maybe in even more depth than the original author remembers. So you kind of... there's no deeper way to understand a field than replication, I think. Because then you really get to, oh, they made this decision, they excluded this participant. And if I don't do that, oops, it's not significant anymore. And all these little things, all the steps an author takes, all this hidden stuff that is never even in the published results. If the study was pre-registered, you might get a better idea of what initially were they setting out to do. But if you just look at the published PDF, you may not learn all that much. When you do replication, you will really learn what's going on in the field. It's unfortunately a very frustrating and painful exercise to do for a student and for me as well. But I don't know, I just, I get back to training is key. Journals are key, funders are key. The whole system has to change. Maybe if you have job panels, I've seen an advertisement. I went to an open science conference in Mannheim in January, and they said that that their own department had put out a job ad, and people who promote transparency are especially encouraged. So I don't know how seriously they were taking that, because also you hear things about women are especially diversity, da da da. But I thought that was a really cool thing to see, that the department would like people to write in their letter, where you go through all the criteria, something about transparency. So if it could be embedded, if transparency and, you know, if that could be embedded on job panels and grants in general and then be enforced and implemented, plus training, I think that that could help. But, I mean, small steps. Yeah?
I think all the things you're putting forward are great, but I'm not convinced that education is, or lack of education is the real problem, because I'm afraid I think your initial comments that human wrongdoing is actually a major issue are very, very true. And perhaps I could give an example.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work somewhere. They did studies for regulators, for safety regulation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They wanted to show that something had a probability of less than 0.25 breaking when dropped on the floor with 95% confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So they worked out they had to drop 119 on the floor and none of them break. No attempt to calculate what actually, if there was a 0.001 probability of breaking, how many would they need then? Just the minimum number possible. Then when they drop, after 50 or so, they drop on the floor and it breaks. To start with, they could just, you know, put that one away, drop another one. We'll count that one as not having broken. So when it was explained to them that this was outright cheating and not allowed, the next time round, they submitted as a study that they'd done something where they used a policy to deal with things they dropped on the floor that I didn't hear about until after they'd sent it off, in fact, a year after they'd sent it off, when they told me, well, we knew we couldn't just do another one. So what we did is when one dropped and it broke, we threw that one away and we dropped three more instead. And if they were all okay, then we thought it was all fine. And, unbelievable!
Yeah.
But this is because they had a colossal incentive for people paying to pass the product.
Yeah.
The incentives work the same, and I sent another excellent example from a kind of animal study. We came together as a kind of a national centre of 3 R's, it's all about replication, and it might be nice to the animals and that sort of thing. These two groups, one was very much a theoretical group, and also a practical group, and they found they were working on exactly the same thing. So they thought, well, let's do a study in which you go off and do your experiments and programs and things, you know, in the basements, and we'll go and play with our fancy computers, and then we'll come together and see what the results were, or you send us your results, and we'll match them up. So they did that. And these guys eventually sent their practical, their sort of empirical laboratory-based results to the theoretical theorists. And also there was absolutely no correspondence whatsoever. They were all trying to discuss about this. And they decided to get together and try and work out what had gone wrong. And in the course of the discussion, there were certain sort of phrases that were used that made the theorists a little nervous, something along the lines of, oh, well, we only sent you the results when the experiments worked. and this is exactly the sort of idea you're suggesting. You know, people say, oh, well, that doesn't work. Well, no, it doesn't work. You know, and sometimes you can tell when things don't work, but it's easier to tell when you do it 100 times, you go, well, that's kind of over there, we've got 99 down here, and then you're not so worried about telling people about this. And they say, well, how often did your experiment actually work? And it turns out that it only worked about 20% of the time. They said, do you have the data from the experiments that didn't work? And they said, well, yes. And so they sent that, and of course that data matched up very well with the theory. I mean, they were simply collecting data that fulfilled their own sense of what they were looking for. And this is absolutely right. Everything I'm hearing about data management and replica, they can't even type numbers from data. I mean, I've got a little note here to say, which would be my data repository. Do you mean the numbers in your R or your Excel spreadsheet? That would be called data. Because if you match that up to the original files of whatever it is you're generating on some fancy machine that shines light or something, and discover how they got there, then are they even the same numbers? You know, so I did a years ago in which they did exactly the experiment, generated piles of paper already old-fashioned, got them all to type the numbers into a spreadsheet in the template, so right, each of you don't copy, want to do it, and nobody looks for mistakes. Nobody is expecting themselves to get it wrong either deliberately or otherwise. And I think ultimately you said it's not technical, it's moral. It is a moral issue. Are you prepared to either turn a blind eye because you think, oh, I've done all this work, I've found this mistake, but you know, I'm going to whisk of getting it published, and that will get me my fellowship, and that will pretty much get me my career, or am I going to torpedo it? And then they discover if they do that, then oh, what they've done is okay, in fact, they're fine. And then they discover it's not just those things they can manipulate. The whole thing is rotting in some ways. There are good people out there, but there's an awful lot of people who are not there because they're just better out.
And that's why I think the culture must change. I mean, that's a big thing to say, and it's difficult to say how, but that's why I keep going on about students and how to train them better. The culture where making mistakes is also, it's a problem that scandals, I said scandals are helpful, but scandals can also be very unhelpful. I deliberately stopped saying the name of the student with the gay marriage study who fabricated everything. I deliberately stopped saying his name in my talks because it's no use to say it. The story doesn't change, but I'm shaming a person who now has moved on. I don't have no idea what's going on with him now, but there's a fine line between uncovering misconduct and starting to shame people when they've done a human error, because that leads to people wanting to hide when they think, oh, I've had a study, I saw something, I'm just going to shut up and hope no one notices. There's a bit of a movement, the blog Retraction Watch, that traces retractions in all different fields. They have started putting out notices for self-corrections, and they call it doing the right thing. So a lot of people have now started correcting their old papers by sending a note to them to kind of, you know, mea culpa, and they are getting a little bit of, you know, positive feedback for it because they dare to do that. And so I think that is, at the moment, a good thing to do, because you will get some praise for being so brave to admit that you did an error. And you know, maybe if we accept more that in science errors happen, it's not great, but it will happen, and it's okay to say that you made one, it's good, then that could maybe improve the situation. The other thing you talked about is the file drawer. Lots of studies that have come out with insignificant results lie in the file drawer and we never know about it, and then the next person spends some more money and time on the same question and also puts it in the file drawer because no one knows, the effect just can't be shown. That's a big problem. But blind peer review or pre-registration might be able to change some of these things. If I know that I have a study that is insignificant, came out with insignificant results, but I know that the journal would judge me, or the peer would judge me on the soundness of my methods and data selection without looking at the results, I would send it in. I would be more inclined not to put it in the file drawer and just forget it.
Do you think there's a role for sites like F1000, which is much more relaxed about that particular issue, but also has a more open approach to peer review?
I don't know all that much about it, so I couldn't say.
Do they have pre or post publication review?
Okay.
I kind of like it, but basically they'll publish anything you send to them and it stays on record. So you do get the opportunity to update, correct.
Mm-hmm.
They like you to send the data, and you don't have to send the data for any figures that you put in and code or analysis and that sort of thing. And the peer reviews come back and they come with names and it's all in. Anyone can comment.
Mm-hmm. So these are post-publication peer reviews?
It's post-publication peer reviews. And of course, some people don't like it very much, because they think, oh, I mean, you can publish anything you like, but of course, there are sort of conventions, if you like. So you have to get so many positive responses from credible reviewers who they will, in the editorial, will sort of check whether or not those get your mates, sort of say. It's called F1000.
Mm-hmm.
F1000 Research.
I like the approach.
I kind of like it, and again, the other problem you have is that very often
I like the idea, and it's often discussed as a, like an innovative thing. These I didn't know that particular one, but I've heard it before. And also sometimes it's discussed when you think about these preprint servers and then the comments on the papers. I think it's generally a good thing. At least speaking for my field, the unless you have a paper in a peer-reviewed journal that is referable, you're not even supposed to put it on your CV. And that is the problem. So if we are stuck with the ref the way it is, your solution is, I think, practical and really useful in the long run, but people may not put their paper there.
I think you get appropriate, positive, you know, peer review.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, God, let's not talk about the Brexit.
Yeah, that will. Or, how about Brexit and Trump, anyone? Okay. I have no idea when this ends. I'm happy to chat.
Well, anyone?
Oh, there was one question, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, so I'm a social scientist and I often use quantitative data.
Yeah.
Sometimes
I'll try and give a short answer. There are conferences and panels on this. I sat on a panel at the Bath Methods Festival about data sharing and qualitative research. I think my short answer is that there are a lot of data and qualitative research, field notes, interview transcripts that are very hard to share as raw material. The UK Data Service has excellent advice on their websites on how to share these things and in which way. And the Odom Institute in the US does similar things. They have started to give advice. Generally, there are two trends. One trend is that qualitative people are slowly thinking about how to make their work transparent, and they work with UK Data Service. And often the trend, they often try to do at least analytical transparency instead of data transparency. That they can't put up their whole notebook, but they will make sure that the method is really clear, at least. So that's a different type of transparency. What I've seen at CUP, what they are doing, Cambridge University Press, they have a new thing, ATI, that's commented articles. You can send in a, if you have published a qualitative article in a Cambridge journal, there's a team that can help you comment on particular sections. Let's say you make a claim that this caused that, it's very simplistic, based on some interviews, you can then, it's an annotation. It's almost like a footnote, but more fancy and more in-depth, and that annotation can then lead to the original source file. Maybe you have uploaded part of an interview with blanked out stuff onto the UK Data Service page, and you can link to that. So there are ways where people try to make this data accessible, at least in snippets where it's really important. You made an important claim, but you can't write all the things all the interviewees said, but you can kind of, so there are now, Cambridge University Press has been good at trying to find ways for that. But generally when I go to qualitative conferences, many people say this doesn't apply to me because I do qualitative work. Because there isn't enough good practice yet to show them how they can do that. So it's very in its infancy, the whole discussion. But there's discussion. I go to these discussions, and I'm always the quantitative person sitting on that panel being bashed by people who have done 1 year of field work and not wanting to give all their field notes to some person they don't know, which I understand. Yeah. But it's a big topic.
So touching on the fraud issue, so I'm saying a lot of court cases that open up the access of some large corporations that deliberately commit silence and ghostwriting silence and entire journals that have been invented just to market a medicine that people can know causes harm, and then because all the problems is there's a line and marketing just covers it up, it's not generally known.
Yeah.
So it's not just that the science is in a poor way, it's that there are influences that push into that direction due to certain financial reasons.
Mm. Yeah.
This is going to run for years, this debate, isn't it? Because it needs to evolve. But I mean, you know, it's been a great discussion, isn't it? I think the discussion 8:25 to 9:10. So that's about 45 minutes. So I mean, it could be a record. Well done.
Right. I mean,
are your slides available online?
Yes, well, we can put them online.